Thank you. Please be seated. All right, we're here for oral argument in our case number CV23-0715, Celine v. Hatch. These proceedings are being video and audio recorded and live streamed, so we ask counsel to please identify yourself and your client at the beginning of your argument. Each side will have 20 minutes. Appellant's counsel is responsible for watching the clock to reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal if desired. Please keep in mind that we've read the briefs and have conferenced the case this morning. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Catherine Connor here for Plaintiff Appellant Alma M. Celine as the trustee of the Celine Family Trust. Mr. Celine is here today to ask you to correct the deciding judge's error of law to shift the burden of consent for prescriptive easement to Mr. Celine.
Can I just begin by asking you to clarify a factual point in the record?
Yes, Your Honor.
The evidence shows, if I'm correct, that the Celine's land is a 500-acre cattle ranch, or what is it used for?
There are some animals on the farm, but it's also used to raise produce, and it has over the years been used for both purposes.
So it's a 500-acre farm.
It's a farm, yes, Your Honor.
And then the Hatch's property is a 226-acre cattle and feed ranch.
That is my understanding, Your Honor. I believe that it is part of a dairy operation.
Okay, but there was testimony that the dairy, it's no longer a dairy farm.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. It was at one point.
Okay, thank you.
Is that it, Your Honor?
Yes, thank you.
May I proceed? To avoid prescriptive easement, Hatches had to show consent. They had to show consent to the saline use of the gravel road, but they had no evidence of consent, as you saw from review of the record. England versus Ali Ong Hing shifts the consent burden to Mr. Saline if the Hatches property was unenclosed. Hatches knew that their property, as Judge Kiley pointed out, of about 226 acres, was mostly fenced, making it mostly enclosed.
But didn't your client admit that it was unenclosed?
Thank you, Your Honor. The admission is clearly false. The admission asked, is this unenclosed rural? And my client did admit it. That's correct, Your Honor. And he recanted it at trial, stating the reason for his confusion, and there can be no prejudice to Hatches because they knew it was mostly enclosed. My client had no ability to know it was unenclosed. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Rule 36 doesn't permit recantation, right? It has to be, one can be relieved of an admission on motion. You can't just repudiate a binding admission under Rule 36.
I would agree, Your Honor, except that in this case, it was recanted at trial, the reason was explained, and there is case law that supports the recantation, and the admission is false. Everybody knows that. Even Mr. Hatch admitted that his property was enclosed. So what we're dealing with, Your Honor, is an error, a mistake, an inability on the part of Mr. Saline to determine whether the property was in fact enclosed or unenclosed, because he had been told he could not return across the gravel road, he could not go onto the Hatches property for fear of being arrested. So he had no ability to confirm.
I think the purpose of the procedure in Rule 36 is that everyone can go to trial comfortable with what the evidentiary record looks like. And I'm not sure it's fair for a party to give the admission and then later during trial get up on the stand and surprise everyone and recant.
Judge Catlett, I agree with you that that is the purpose of the rule. But in this case, the question that was asked was already known. So Hatches asked a question that they were the only ones that truly knew the answer to. They knew their property was mostly enclosed. So the purpose of an admission is to narrow issues for trial, yet it was extensively testified about trial.
But your client has had the property next door for decades, and they didn't know that this property was enclosed?
I think that the property is larger and goes across Love Road, and he doesn't. He admitted that. He doesn't. I think that the point here, Your Honors, and I understand, and your questions are excellent. I have the same ones. But the problem here is Hatches knew the truth, and they knew the admission was false. So they weren't surprised at all. It's their property, not my client's. My client doesn't know. And in fact, it was really clear from the testimony, he thinks it's only 50 acres. He doesn't realize it's 226. So he clearly, he meaning Mr. Saleen, is clearly uninformed about someone else's property. And he has no ability to go on that property and determine the truth.
Let me ask you about the burden of proof issue. The standard of review issue that you raise. When the parties agreed that they would allow Judge Latham to step in and decide the case, was there any discussion or objection on the part of your client that the standard of review on appeal would be different because of the manner in which the trial was being resolved?
No, Judge Kiley, there was not.
Well, isn't that a waiver then of any claim that there should be a different standard of review other than the normal abuse of discretion standard?
I do not think that it was necessary to preserve that objection. The request was, can we determine on this transcript? It was not, and do you waive your rights? It was, can I decide on this transcript? And my client agreed because that was the transcript. That was what happened at trial. And the recent case law that I believe it was Division I, has come down with, Sims, indicates that we are moving more and more away from giving complete discretion to a non-hearing, so it would be a deciding judge. I do not think that's a waiver. That's not knowing and intelligent. It's simply,
well,
you
not,
may review the transcript. Yes,
not,
Your Honor.
You're not on appeal yet, so I don't think your client has any reason to argue whether the standard of review on appeal is de novo versus abuse of discretion at that point.
Much better stated than I did, Your Honor.
But isn't it fair to say that the Hatches may not have agreed to allow Judge Latham to review the case if they had known that the Saleens were going to take a different position, a position that a different standard of review on appeal would apply?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so. I think the parties hoped that the reviewing judge would review the transcript carefully and reach an appropriate decision. I don't think that before a ruling has been made, that parties are back here thinking, oh, gee, what about an appeal? Now, we are when we're dealing with evidentiary issues, which many were not preserved, and I pointed them out to you. But I don't believe that the Hatches have been harmed in any event. They have had their opportunity to make their arguments as they are here. The transcript speaks for itself. It does not support the deciding judge's ruling.
Well, getting back to the standard of review, though, a party is entitled to one trial. And it seems to me that you're asking for us to do a second trial. Judge Latham reviews the record, does the trial, and now we're going to do a trial de novo, essentially, is what you're asking us to do, right?
Judge Kiley, I disagree. I am not asking you to do a new trial. I am asking you to do a de novo review of a trial transcript. And that's what your Sims case, and I have some of the others that I've referred. See if I can find real quick. Holcomb, Webb, Pierce, and the most recent Sims. That's what appellate courts do when we have a situation where the deciding judge did not have the opportunity to make a determination about credibility or weigh the evidence or listen to how the parties testified.
Sims is a case under 12910F, which has an instruction from the legislature telling us that we have to do de novo review. I know you rely on a Missouri case, I think from the 1950s, but in that case, there was a procedural rule that instructed the courts to do a de novo review. What, do you have a procedural rule or statute in Arizona that would instruct us to do that here, or are you just asking us sort of imply from the circumstances that we should do de novo review?
The latter, Your Honor, and implied from Holcomb, Webb, and Pierce. I gave you those citations. I think that our problem here is the transcript speaks for itself. The transcript was not followed by the deciding judge. Had he followed it, he would have ruled in my client's favor. However, he incorrectly shifted the burden of proof based upon a known-to-be-false admission.
Well, that sort of touches on my next question,
yes, sir.
Which was, does the standard of review matter? In other words, do you win under de novo but lose under abuse of discretion?
Your Honor,
I suspect your answer is no. You win under either.
Yes, right? That is my answer. That is my answer, Your Honor. Correct. I believe that either way, Mr. Saleen, on behalf of the family trust, wins and gets a prescriptive easement, because the standards to obtain an easement by prescription were clearly met here. There was no proof of consent by Hatches, zero. There were all the other elements proven by Mr. Saleen.
There was evidence that the Saleen family used the road and so forth for many years. There was also evidence from Mr. Saleen. He said, when discussing the shared pond, he said, my dad would never encroach on somebody else's property. So isn't that an admission that his father wouldn't have used the gravel road in an encroaching manner, that he would only have done it if he had the permission of the landowner?
I don't think so. I think that the encroachment there that's being discussed is a taking. That would be the pond is actually physically taking a chunk of land. And so I think that Mr. Saleen was truthfully testifying that his dad would not go and take someone else's property, but a right to cross a road that's been crossed for over 100 years by not only Mr. Saleen, all of his employees, his family, his now deceased parents, his grandparents, and other people that live on the road. It's only Mr. Saleen that they're trying to keep off the road. So that needs to be really clear. So I don't think that conflates that a pond being relocated that was right on the property line that would affect property boundaries. That's different. The use of a road is a use that is that allows the Hatches to still maintain their ownership. Did that answer your question, Judge Kiley?
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you.
Were there any other questions before I proceed?
So you're relying on the time period between 1960 and 1970?
That is correct, Your Honor.
How many times did the Salines use the road between 1960 and 1970?
The testimony as demonstrated by the transcript is daily.
Where daily does not appear in the transcript.
I don't want to argue with the judge, but I believe it says we used it almost daily growing up. And that was the language. So if I've misstated, I apologize, but I know the word daily was used, and I can find it if you want me to.
Okay. I guess let me ask a similar question with respect to the...
Judge Catlett, Judge Kiley, did you want me to get you the site?
Well, if you'd like to, I'll consider it. I'll go back and do another word search
of the transcript. I know the word daily is used, may I make a note just to get that for Judge Kiley? And I'll come back to it, Judge Kiley. Go ahead, Judge Catlett.
Thank you. So there's a lot of discussion about the presumption in Ong Hing.
Yes.
And I'll ask a similar question as I did with respect to the appellate standard of review.
Yes.
Do you need that presumption to win?
No, because I believe that we have demonstrated that there was no consent. Every time any minor blockage was put across that road, Saleen's drove over it. They just kept coming, according to Mrs. Hatch's testimony. So the only time that they have been stopped is in this lawsuit when the pile of dirt went up and they were told by the, I believe it was county sheriff, that they couldn't go on that road. It had to be resolved in court.
Piles of dirt went up in the past, too, didn't they?
And they drove over them. This is quite a pile, if you've seen the picture.
Well, what there was testimony that David Saleen asked them to remove the previous pile of dirt, and that they did when he agreed to make certain concessions, which indicates an acknowledgement that the Hatches had a superior right to control the land, doesn't it?
I disagree, Your Honor. The discussion was after the taking had occurred, and we don't know what was said. Mr. Saleen is dead. That was a dead man statute violation. It was objected to, but David wasn't there to say what was or wasn't said. So I don't think you can listen to that testimony. And in any event, they just kept coming, as Mrs. Hatch testified.
What about the evidence that Mr. Saline called to ask if he could take the manure over the road? Isn't that an admission that he needs permission to drive over the road?
Judge Kiley, that's an excellent question. There is an unfortunate lack of clarity in the testimony. And when you review that carefully, Mr. Saline said, I wasn't asking for permission to go over the gravel road. I was asking for permission to go over the well road. And that was what was denied because they did not want to, I'm not really an engineer, but it had to do with the irrigation pipes and the irrigation water. And that's what was the request, was to go that way. That does not acknowledge that Mr. Saline does not have a right to use the gravel road. And I hesitated because sometimes I said, granite, it is gravel road. What that is an attempt to be neighborly. And if something's irritating your neighbor, you reach out to him and say, hey, if I did this, would this be better? That's not a statement or an acknowledgement of a lack of a right. Absolutely not.
Your client has another way to access their property, right, besides the road that's at issue here?
Not legally, Your Honor. He testified and it's quite clear. He could only do so by trespassing over the state trust land. That's the road out to the east, and he has no such right. Is he getting to his property? Yes. Is it legal? No. If he needs to sell the property in the future, does he have legal access? No. And those are fighting words in Arizona. Access to our lands is just up there with water. It's very critical.
Did you argue easement by necessity?
No, we did not have proof of easement of necessity, Judge. We obtained that after we learned, and I did not know, neither previous counsel didn't know, my client didn't know, there was an extensive record regarding the patent that was obtained by my client's grandfather. And it was only when we obtained that in January of 2024 that it stated that at the time of severance, when that patent deed was granted to my client's grandfather, it was granted without a right-of-way. That was critical evidence. We didn't have that. In order to get an easement of necessity, you have to establish that at the time of severance, the property was conveyed without access, which is the easement of necessity concept, that no one would give land without access.
And so that argument was raised for the first time in the motion for new trial, correct?
I didn't raise an easement of necessity claim here. I raised in post-hearing or post-ruling motions this new evidence that I obtained. I came to you and I asked the Court of Appeals for permission to go back to the trial court and present it properly, and that was denied, and then I came back.
Well, the claim about the land being landlocked was raised for the first time in the motion for new trial, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. Your Honors, may I reserve 2 minutes? Thank you, Your Honors. And I'll get the site for Judge Kiley.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hunt.
Good morning to the panel, and may it please the court. Marshall Hunt from firm Davis Miles on behalf of the defendants and appellees, Wesley and Charlotte Hatch. Your Honors, to me, this case, and really all of the legal issues that have been discussed and will be discussed, are about finality. My clients, as I'm sure Mr. Saline is, are good people living on the land where their ancestors, grandparents, homesteaded in Navajo County. But for the last 5 years and running, there's been a pall over that land in the form of Mr. Saline and this quixotic drive that he has to get some of my clients' property rights for free, for nothing. And frankly, I take a little bit of umbrage at counsel's argument that, no, we're not talking about property, we're talking about a right to use a road. That is property. That is one of the bundle of rights that my clients have owned for generations in this land, is the right to both use and exclude others from using their property. And what was presented in this case and what Judge Latham finally decided was that Mr. Saleen does not have a right to use my client's property without their permission.
What can Judge Latham do with a cold record that we can't do with a cold record?
Judge Latham can act as trial courts are supposed to act. And so everyone knows at this point, and you're right, that this case is strange procedurally. We had a trial judge recuse herself after the presentation of evidence. We had a long delay where the case found its way to the presiding judge. There's no judges in Navajo County that could decide the case without a conflict, and so we get Judge Latham as a visiting judge. But what Judge Latham did at that point is he reviewed the record in full. He had all of the trial exhibits that I don't know if they're all necessarily part of the court record on appeal. But what he ultimately did is do what trial judges do, which in a bench trial situation, decide disputed issues of fact, render those facts, and make a decision. And so with respect to the issue of the proper standard of review, we made the point in our brief, and I just want to emphasize it here, that asking this court to review de novo as appellants do, as the U.S. Supreme Court case said in Pierce, would strangely distort the appellate process and would not produce the, quote, normal law clarifying benefits of appellate review. And so in this case, what this court does is it generally will decide de novo issues of law. And while I'm sure, again, as he has with every issue presented in this appeal, that Mr. Saleen wants another bite of the apple and he wants another court to relook at the issues and determine them afresh for him, hoping that if he keeps asking, someone will give him what he wants, there's no reason in the structure of our judicial system for this court to do that.
Did Judge Latham have a recording of the trial or just the written transcript?
There was a partial recording. This is part of the comedy of errors that we dealt with in the aftermath here, that we had a partial recording from basically the first morning break until the end of the day, but the first part of Mr. Saleen's testimony was cut off. And so we had a partial transcript from that recording, but thankfully the parties had requested an in-person court reporter, and so we had the full transcript from the court reporter. So while that issue wasn't substantially briefed, it is true that Judge Latham would at the very least have access to the audio recording. It doesn't give him the ability to see someone face-to-face, but he can hear someone's inflections, whether they hesitate, and does, again, give him the opportunity to do what a trial judge does, which is to decide disputed issues of law and render a decision based on the facts.
How much was recorded of the what percentage?
Yes, it'd be about 75% of the day. So,
okay.
Yeah, I mean, the trial started at 9, I believe. Morning break was at 10:30 in the morning. And from there is when the recording seems to have run and gone through the remainder of the one-day trial.
Is there evidence in the record that Judge Latham relied on this partial recording in his ruling, or did he rely just on the transcript?
I do not have any knowledge one way or the other on that issue. I know that the parties did permit Judge Latham authorized Judge Latham to rule based on the transcript. I do not know whether he listened to the recording. But
didn't he bring it to the party's attention that the recording was not complete?
Yes.
And they agreed that the decision would be made based on the transcript, right?
That is my understanding of the record, yes.
I guess I'll ask you the flip question that I asked counsel. Does it matter for your purposes of your client whether we use de novo or some other standard?
It doesn't, and frankly, to get ahead of one of those other flip questions, whether we're de novo or abuse of discretion, whether we're the open, rural, unenclosed standard under the Etz in England and LaRue cases, or if we're in the more traditional prescriptive easement standard that's, for instance, in this court's Spalding decision that's in some of the opening brief, I think my clients win either way, and that's in part because the burden issues in this case. Mr. Saleen, obviously the plaintiff, bears the burden of all of the adverse possession issues, open, notorious, hostile, under a claim of right, it's continuous, et cetera. And I found it surprising, frankly, in this appeal that Mr. Saleen's case essentially hinges on this idea that there is sufficient evidence in the record that Judge Latham would have been compelled to find that Mr. Saleen used this disputed road continuously from 1960 to 1970. That's essentially his theory of the case. I don't see that in the record. I was the trial counsel. I've obviously read back through the transcript. There's some vague comments about Mr. Saleen returning to live at the property in approximately 1960 after having lived in Gila County, I believe, but I do not read the transcript as conclusively establishing that he, in fact, did continuously use that road from 1960 to 1970 in such a way that this court would be compelled to reverse and direct a ruling in Mr. Saleen's favor.
Now, I guess on the presumption for unenclosed land, does that apply, like, regardless? It's unenclosed, and therefore the presumption applies even if the road is running right in front of the house and they can see the traffic? Seems odd. Seems like there's a mismatch between those facts and what the presumption is intended to do.
Yeah, it's understandable, but if you look at the actual facts of LaRue and Etz and England, I don't read those cases to turn, for instance, on the land that the alleged servient tenement landowner's knowledge of the action. It was more about...
Because the presumption is based on cattle grazing, right?
In England, it had to do with cattle grazing, and I will note, cattle grazing over 80 acres of land. So, you know, the England court did show a willingness to kind of try to do some of this line drawing to say, when is this presumption shift? What type of land? And so we do have approximately three times as large of a parcel here owned by the Hatches. But the LaRue case was a road access case, and so that was more similar to the facts of this case. And I don't read England to have, have turned on either the question of knowledge or the question of the use of the land, such as cattle grazing. The issue was, are we going to have a different standard in these Western states that we live in, derived from some Texas and California cases that these Arizona cases cite, to apply to rural, unenclosed land? That's what the clarifying interpretation that this court gave in that 2008 Spalding case to distinguish more urban, smaller, say a suburban single-family home lot to these large rural lots like we're talking about in this case. And so if we're focusing on the issue of finality, the thing that flies in the face of that important bedrock legal principle in this case more than anything is this question of Mr. Saleen's admission as to the nature of this property. And
yeah, what do we do with when we have an answer to a request for admission that is then in conflict with trial testimony?
And I will say that I don't think it substantially conflicts to the trial testimony, but I'll answer the question first. Rule 36, its entire purpose is to conclusively establish things for trial. My clients served requests for admission. Mr. Saleen answered. Rule 36 permits him to say, I don't know the answer to that, and I can't discover that under Rule 36A5C. He didn't do that. Rule 36 permits him to deny that request. He didn't do that. He checked, admit. 1 month after he served that request for admission, my clients filed a summary judgment motion. And the star evidence in that motion was, you admitted this is open, rural, unenclosed land. We want to apply the England line of cases. We should win on summary judgment because you can't show that you specifically made it clear to us that you were using our road under a hostile claim of right. He knew very, very directly and clearly the purpose for which my clients were going to use that admission. He didn't move to amend that admission. He didn't move to withdraw that admission as he would have been required to do under Rule 36. Instead, he goes to trial. At trial, I present him with the admission, and he says, yep, I made that admission. I remember making it. I remember reviewing it before my counsel submitted this response. And he starts to wishy-wash a little bit. He says, well, I don't know. It's in the city limits, for instance. But I direct the court to Judge Latham's ruling, which I think does a good job following in the vein of the England case, really drilling down into determining, is this rural property? Is this unenclosed property? And he used, for instance, things like the definition of an urban area to look at this property specifically on the ground and say, yes, this is rural. A long way of saying that it frankly doesn't matter that he tried to backpedal a little bit on his admission at trial. My clients didn't come to trial, for instance, with evidence of how much of this property is enclosed and how much is open, to try to assist the trial court in making that determination, because he admitted it 6 months before trial. We prepared for trial specifically based on his admission. And so the extreme prejudice to say, well, after the parties devoted all their resources, got all the way to trial, went through a whole day of presentation of evidence, at a time, even at trial, when Mr. Saleen didn't ask to withdraw his admission, didn't ask to amend his admission, but just moved on, to allow that to change on appeal would be, frankly, make a mockery of Rule 36 and make it unuseful as a tool of discovery and undermine its core purpose, which is, again, to limit the issues for purposes of trial that don't need to be in dispute.
What is your view on what the trial testimony says about how frequently this road was used by the Salines in the decade between 1960 and 1970?
I think it doesn't say very much about the decade between 1960 and 1970, and I think that overall, including in that decade, I would agree with Judge Latham that the use was occasional. Again, this is an issue of burden of proof, whether or not we're acting under the England cases or we're acting under, say, Spalding or the more traditional non-urban or non-rural cases, that it was Mr. Saleen's obligation to provide trial evidence regarding a continual use of the road for 10 years. And frankly, it was Judge Latham's prerogative and within his discretion to just look at the testimony in this case and say, I don't really believe Mr. Saleen. This is very much a... two witnesses on our side, one witness on their side, and very, very little documentary evidence about what this use constituted, how frequent it was, and what was done. You know, Mr. Saleen testified
Did Judge Latham determine Mr. Saleen said the use was frequent, but I don't believe him? Or did he determine Mr. Saleen never said the use was frequent?
I read his ruling to be the latter, that his... You know, separate and apart from the believability aspect of it, I read his ruling to say, just looking at the face of the trial transcript, at most, Mr. Saleen showed that the use was occasional. I only make the point that even the evidence of occasional use is so sparse that it would be within Judge Latham's right to simply not believe Mr. Saleen's testimony. You know, looking at what use was actually made, we have testimony about the occasional bringing of large pieces of equipment across the road, occasional bringing crops out of the road, but certainly not anything that is so continual and specific that this court should step in on appeal and decide that Judge Latham, who had the blessing of the parties, who they asked to rule based on the trial transcript, and just second guess him for no reason other than that Mr. Saleen is unsatisfied with Judge Latham's ruling and wants another bite at the apple.
So you're not going to like this assumption, but assume we think there was a prescriptive easement created, I guess, in 1970 based on 10 years of continuous use. What does relief look like at that point? Does the easement still exist? It seems odd for us to be looking at a time period that is between 55 and 65 years ago. But, I mean, I guess prescriptive easements run with the land?
Prescriptive easements do generally run with the land, and, you know, this issue didn't substantially arise between the parties, but I believe that it would likely be true that an easement exists once the 10-year period has run. Whether or not it's come in front of a court, it accrues as a matter of law. I think the easement could potentially have been abandoned at some point. You know, it's really outside, frankly, of the trial record for the court. But the reality here is that...
Would there need to be parameters on the easement, how the road is used?
Yes.
Who? So I guess we would remand for those issues to be hashed out?
Yes, and that would certainly be an important issue for my clients, because the scope of use did change over time and did, frankly, contribute to this dispute getting to the courts, because at some times we have personal vehicles traveling the road, and other times we have large tractor-trailer semi-rigs traveling the road. And as the trial transcript contained, there were issues related to damaging septic lines and the like that would contribute to the evidence regarding the scope of any easement that was established. But frankly, again, looking at the trial transcript, we can't determine that even from this period of 1960 to 1970, there was an easement established, both because, again, on the standard burden shifting analysis, there was substantial and certainly sufficient evidence regarding a permissive use, both implied and express, that Judge Latham was justified in ruling that the use had always been permissive.
Do you agree with your colleague's comment that the request to use the road to transport manure related to a different road, not the gravel road that we're talking about here?
That was not my understanding of the transcript. It's, again, not an issue that substantially arose in the briefs, and I'd want to read it again, but my understanding of that particular use of the road was that it was permissive. And frankly, the other issues with regard to the permissive use were even more expressed. The panel asked counsel about David Saleen's request for permission, and that was certainly admissible evidence. That wasn't my line of questioning. That was plaintiff's counsel, after having earlier objected on the basis of the dead man statute, then himself asked questions about Mr. David Saleen's history with the Hatches, asking permission, complying with their request that they not use the road. And this is, again, evidence both of express permission and implied permission.
Just real quick, what do you know about alternate access to the property?
I think counsel's basic understanding is my understanding. I know that the record before the court is that since my clients blocked the road in 2020, both Mr. Saleen and his sister-in-law, who lives on the Saleen property, have continued to access via alternative means. I'm unaware of any dispute with that from the state regarding their use of the state trust land.
Yeah, I was going to say, are they trespassing when they do that?
I think that, again, this issue hasn't been briefed, but it's likely they have an implied right of necessity from the state or from whichever government entity gave them their property. And I thank the panel.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
To start, Your Honors, with Judge Kiley's question about the question about daily use, I would refer you to transcript page 145 at lines 8 through 15. The answer is, the question was, how were you using what you're referring to as the prescriptive easement? Answer, just daily, comma, all of our lives growing up there, period. That was open, period. We used it for horticulture, period. We used to take agricultural products up that road, period. It was just open. It was our only entrance into the headquarters, well, ranch and farm there. So the word daily is there. Second, I want to address the Rule 36 argument that the motion for summary judgment was filed and denied. So was a JMOL at the end of Mr. Saleen's case.
But did the Hatches rely on your client's answer to the request for admission in the motion for summary judgment?
I believe that they probably did, but it was denied. Right, he said that it was front and center.
Right. I think his point was, though, at that point, if you wanted to recant, you should have done it, because it's a pretty good signal to you that that's going to be the centerpiece of their case at trial, too.
I can't speculate what former counsel thought or did, because I wasn't there. I do know that the testimony was recanted at trial. There was no retained objection. It was not preserved, and the testimony was allowed. And then there was a question, I think the suggestion from opposing counsel was that the Hatches were prejudiced because they weren't able to testify about the quantity of their land that was enclosed versus what was unenclosed. Yet I found and cited at the trial transcript that they knew precisely that it was approximately 220 acres, so that's not precise. I back up. They could estimate that it was approximately 220 acres enclosed with fencing, and about 6 acres was unenclosed, and I cited that as the trial transcript, pages 67 at lines 3 through 25, 68 at lines 22 through 69.3, and at 98, lines 21 through 99.2.
All right. I think we're out of time. Thank you for your briefing and your argument in the matter. We will take it under advisement and get you a ruling in due course.
Thank you, Your Honor.